It's Wednesday, so it's This Week in Chicago History Day with Anna DeVlantis. Good morning, Anna. Let's talk about the Great Chicago Flood first.
Oh, you know, where were you, Bob, on the morning of April 13th, 1992? Do you remember? Were you part of this whole thing?
You know what? I was going on vacation. I was on the way to O'Hare hearing about what was going on, and I couldn't believe it.
You know, it was interesting because if you were making your way into the loop early enough on the morning of the Great Chicago Flood in 92, you might have thought things were sort of normal because up above ground in some places it still kind of did look normal that morning. But down below, fish were already literally swimming in the basement of the merchandise mart, and city officials were very aware that this was going to be a real issue. A lot of flooding below street level that was starting to rise very quickly. Flood caused nearly 2 weeks of chaos in the loop, nearly $2 billion in damages. And it all came down to those deep tunnels, you know, that had been carved out at the turn of the century by the Illinois Telephone and Telegraph Company, long forgotten, and lots of cracks and lots of things over time that just been overlooked, you know, patchet jobs, as there were a lot of calls for, you know, alarm already over the years. We pulled some audio here I think you'll love from the legendary Bill Curtis, who at the time was an anchor at CBS2 and on the anchor desk that day. He compares the Great Chicago Flood to that other disaster that struck the city in 1871.
The last time Chicago was witness to such an event was about 120 years ago, when, as rumor has it, a cow kicked over a lantern and started a fire that would burn for 2 days and leave Chicago little more than a pile of rubble. The city's nervous system, a maze of circuits that bring us the power to use tools of the modern world, was vulnerable. The core of our underground transportation system stopped, and we're not exactly sure when we'll see it operating again. The last time Marshall Fields was closed for this period of time was after the fire in 1871. Back then, they reopened in a stable the very next day. We haven't done as well this time. Who would have thought? Almost as far from the ocean as you can get, divers have become our lifeline. For that matter, who would believe that pilings under a bridge would have the same significance a cow and a lantern has had for 100 years.
Did they ever pinpoint the exact cause of all that, Anna?
You know, they did, and the structural engineers had a lot of work to do ahead of them, but there was that guy, the flood stud, his name was John Kenny, and he was a construction guy. He was just a straight-talking guy at a time when no one seemed to be talking very straight. Everyone was pointing fingers, and his dive teams were the ones that plugged the hole and got it, you know, got the city back to normal, and then they went back and did the structural repairs. So,
wow.
Should be good for another 100 years, I hope.
Yeah,
so.
That was 1992. This week in 1899, Houdini's trick kind of went amiss, didn't it?
It went south. You know, it's interesting. Chicago plays a role in so many of the careers of budding stars at this time, at the turn of the century. Harry Houdini was here in Chicago to try to cement his reputation and his stardom as this escape artist, the best one in the world. And he proved it by going to the Central Police Station in Chicago and before several hundred people, police detectives and dignitaries and all kinds of things, he was able to get out of police handcuffs. And so he was, wow, he had done it. But then he put out an ad in the paper and said, I will pay $50, which is a lot of money at the time, for anybody who can make me stay in handcuffs and I won't be able to escape. Well, an Evanston cop foiled him, figured out that he was adjusting the springs or something inside the handcuffs, and was able to manipulate him so that Harry couldn't get out. And so he was able to collect the $50 and almost ruined his reputation, but things worked out okay for Harry Houdini. He got a lot of he staged a lot of stunts and probably learned an important lesson from that cop, that you got to check out the stuff before you perform the stunts, and never made that mistake again.
that was an Evanston police officer.
An Evanston police officer answered the call to get the $50 and said, "I think I know what he's doing. It's the spring and mechanism that if I just, you know, just alter that, this Harry Houdini guy, you know, I'll get him."
Wow. let's get to some TV history and a Chicago connection from 1974,
Good Times, debuted the 50th anniversary of the show. It was set in Chicago based on a fictional Chicago family living in the Cabrini Green housing project. The Evans family, it was It was written by a Chicago native, Eric Monte, and Mike Evans, who played Lionel Jefferson on The Jeffersons. Also, Norman Lear was the producer on that. And it was just interesting because, you know, like a lot of sitcoms at that time, they were sanitized. The families, things kind of looked perfect. They had little problems and everything got resolved. But this show approached poverty and racism and even Chicago corruption. We pulled a clip. I think you'll enjoy, Bob. The local alderman in the show, who made a lot of appearances, would regularly visit the Evans household and often had his hand out, but really didn't care about any of their problems.
Alderman Davis, what is this I hear about the daycare center closing down? I have one question I'd like to ask you. Do you have any idea how important that daycare center is to the working women? Now, how can you let them close the center down?
I'm glad you asked that question, Winsomnium.
My name is Wilona Baldy.
Tell me, how are the Evans, my favorite project family?
Oh, they're fine.
And, of course, how are you two, Winoni? You see, the center depends on funds from the federal government that are channeled in through the city payroll. Unfortunately, those funds are temporarily frozen.
Frozen?
Yeah.
I suggest somebody look in your pocket. I bet they find some icicles.
And now there's a new version of Good Times, isn't there?
They had the animated version. I heard Dean talking about it with you, that debuted on Netflix last week, produced by Steph Curry, Seth MacFarlane, and also Norman Lear involved in it. So that's out there, totally different version. We'll see how that one is received and how people like it.
The National Barn Dance radio show, 100 years old, and actually survived into the late 60s right here in WGN, didn't it, Anna?
That's right. Florian Samuelson, we're going to get to an interview you did with him in just a second, Bob. But it's the 1930s and 1940s. Think about this. Chicago was the country music capital of the world, and it all really traces back to this week 100 years ago when the National Barn Dance debuted on Chicago radio and just drew a huge audience, lots of appetite all across America, but rural America especially, to be drawn to the country music stars who were on the radio, and every star wanted to be the part of it. Gene Autry, the list goes on. It's interesting because it really set the stage for country music's explosion and the Grand Ole Opry and everything that came after that. Interesting, I looked into this. Bob Atcher was a local man who became a country star. He performed on the National Barn Dance in 1948, then hosted the show while simultaneously serving as the mayor of Schaumburg. So kind of interesting to see that connection. I guess back then Schaumburg probably was country anyway, but it was interesting to see so many local figures who came out. And as you pointed out, when the Barn Dance broadcast was canceled across the street at the other radio station, WGN Radio picked it up and was hosted by none other than Orion Samuelson. Here's part of that interview you did with him for News Nation, I believe.
I imagine you still milking cows while you're in broadcasting.
Well, and I did, because WKLJ in Sparta, Wisconsin, 17 miles from my home, a daytime radio station. So I'd get up in the morning and I'd help Dad milk cows, and then I'd drive 17 miles to the radio station, which was a daytimer, not a clear channel. It was a daytimer. And then I'd get home in the summer. When we had daylight saving time, I'd get home in time to help milk cows at night. So I was a polka disc jockey during the day and the cow milker in the morning and the evening.
Always good to hear.
Love
big
that.
O. Let's get to some Wrigley Field history, Anna.
That was such a great interview, by the way. So everyone should go back and watch it. I was watching it in preparation for this, Bob. Oh, it's such a wonderful interview.
Oh, thanks.
April 20th, 1916, Cubs played their very first game at the Friendly Confines. This is the week. It was then known as Wegman Park, soon to be Wrigley Field. Charlie Wegman, a local lunch meat entrepreneur, a lunch counter business that was just thriving across the city. It was kind of like the early version of fast food. He became very rich, but then his fortunes kind of faded, and that's when William Wrigley, who owned some shares of the team in the ballpark, took over, bought him out, and the rest, as they say, is history. He was things have changed a bit in Wrigleyville since that time.
Especially in the last few years. We finally have a connection now to report, and I've never heard this before. Chicago softball influencing daylight saving time?
Wow. I knew you'd love this one, Bob. I was like, this has got Bob's name written all over it. A lot of people, you know, Bob, say that Benjamin Franklin is often credited with suggesting and influencing the adaptation of daylight saving time because he wanted to save candles. But I went back and looked in the history books, and the role of Chicago softball players is quite a big one. In 1941 in Chicago, the city was deciding if they would adapt this new form of daylight saving time. At the time, they had the thing where they would push ahead an hour the last Sunday in April and then turn it back, the clocks back, the last Sunday in September. Well, the city was considering moving the fall back part to the end of October to give people more daylight in the fall. And the softball players really organized to try to get the city to adapt this because they all wanted to go play softball in daylight after work. And really became a big vocal advocacy group in adapting this. And ultimately, the city did adopt this whole thing. And it's interesting because, of course, there were people who said it'd be less crime, there'd be fewer traffic accidents, there would be more people in stores, so it'd be great for the economy. But it became a quality of life issue. And Chicago softball players, there you go, Bob, they were a big part of it.
How about that? I thought we were only responsible for helping orthopedic surgeons and giving them a lot of business with all the hand surgeries. Anna DeBlantis, This Week in Chicago History, sponsored by UChicagoMedicine.org. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday. Thank you, Anna.
Talk to you then, Bob.